My name is Chuck Palahniuk, and you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland.
You are not special. You are not a beautiful or unique snowflake. Same decaying organic matter as everything else.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers, the radio show where authors join us in the studio to talk about the mystical act of setting down words on the page. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today is an internationally acclaimed novelist and journalist. His works include Invisible Monsters, Choke, Haunted, and Fugitives and Refugees, not to mention Fight Club and Fight Club 2, the graphic novel. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella. Yes, it is indeed an adult coloring book, featuring art by Steve Morris, Mike Norton, Duncan Fregretto, and Nate Picos. Chuck Palahniuk, welcome to Between the Covers.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell our listeners about Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. This is your second coloring book after Bait, which was a collection of short stories.
Right. This was a story that wasn't going to quite be a novel, and it was too long to be a short story, and it was kind of a fantasy, and it seemed perfect to do another coloring book with.
Yeah, so there's sort of an elegiac introduction to Legacy, where you talk about a memento box that your grandmother kept, which got lost in the shuffle. And your takeaway from this, you write, "Now I tend to think that my life began with me, which is a mistake and a lie, and means I'll never have a full understanding of the forces that created me. But it still irks me to think that my buttons will not be strung in a cotton string and added to the box. So I've written Legacy because we would all like physical proof of our history, plus a guide person to explain it. We'd all like to meet the chain of people to whom we're linked." This is something that I think especially adoptees, refugees, anybody without a solid family history can appreciate.
Especially people of my father's generation. My family immigrated to the U.S. in 1917, and they were determined to become as American as they could be as quickly as possible. So we had no Ukrainian language or heritage. And I'm really only learning about those things from my own readers, more recent Ukrainian immigrants who are teaching me how to say my own name.
And how do you say your own name?
We say Palahniuk. But that is incorrect.
Oh. And we're going to stop there.
And I'm not even going to attempt the correct way. But they tell me it is the most Ukrainian of Ukrainian names.
Wow. So let's get to Legacy. The MacGuffin in the book is a dwarf peach tree.
Right. A bonsai tree. And in a way, I wanted to retell the story of the Buddha's enlightenment and how this kind of party boy, this kind of guy who's sort of wasted and dissipated his life while relatively young, achieved enlightenment by sitting underneath a tree. But in this case, I wanted the tree to be very small and I wanted the man to be very large, so that instead of the tree sheltering the man and bringing enlightenment, it was the man sheltering the tree. So this kind of a douchebag becomes the custodian of this ancient tree that is bequeathed to him by the father that he was unaware was even alive.
Yeah, the story in Legacy, it follows the arc of the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell always wrote about. But the protagonist in Legacy is no hero. He's a misogynistic bond trader on Wall Street whose favorite author is Ayn Rand.
Right, and also has a copy of Art of the Deal in his apartment. The artist wanted to put in all of these kind of wonderfully corrupt things. But he has to start out as this kind of rough character in order to achieve any kind of enlightenment. So he has to be very unlikable at the beginning.
And he goes through the whole series of alchemical transformations where you get burned and ground into powder and all those things along the road before you get redeemed.
Right, and it's a small redemption by the end. I didn't want it to be too metaphysical, but it's a redemption.
You have a little bit of exposition in the book about how trees and fruit, magic fruit, appear in tales from cultures around the world. I mean, of course, there's the Book of Genesis with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's Celtic tales. There's Asian tales. There's Middle Eastern tales.
Right. It's such a cross-cultural archetype that it was easy to do, and to take this tree and to morph it from just a seemingly valueless thing, and then to find out it's so old, and in and of itself it has this fantastic value that can be cashed in for possessions, and then to morph it into something that provides immortality. And that's why it is being sought after by the most corrupt people in the world, to take this object and to constantly morph its definition, its value, is really important in any story. If you look at a story like Breakfast at Tiffany's, one object is the ring that's discovered in a box of Cracker Jack. And that ring is given by the former husband to the new suitor, to the narrator of the book. And that ring is eventually brought out at Tiffany's when they need something to engrave for the moment. And then that ring is brought out at the very end of the narrative and presented in the movie to cement the relationship, but in the book to end the relationship. So something that's really crucial to a good story is to have the same object come back again and again, but with a more profound meaning to it every time it reappears.
And the ring is a perfect symbol because it's a circle, it's gold, which is incorruptible, so you just keep looping around on this circle.
And also, you know, if you've read Nora Ephron's fantastic novel, Heartburn, it's the same thing. It centers around a ring, and every time that ring reappears, it's another plot point, and the plot's going to go in a whole different direction.
Let's have a little excerpt from Legacy, an off-color novella that gives a little of the background to the bonsai peach tree of immortality.
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
If Baccarat could be believed, the tree was documented in Asian mythology. It had once grown in the garden of the Jade Emperor and his wife, Shi Wangmu. Its fruit bestowed immortality. It's why even today Chinese birthday cakes and pastries are decorated with images of peaches. The way she'd explained it, almost every culture believed in some magic fruit. Even white people. Norse and Celtic mythologies held that a sacred apple granted eternal youth. I'll leave it at that.
All righty. You don't want to go on any further?
It gets a little more abstract.
Well, you are fond of mythology. Are you okay with the term fairy tale?
I am. And I think that the one thing that we forget is that mythology is a constantly evolving thing, and that we ourselves have the power to create a mythology more appropriate or more applicable to our times. And I think people forget that we should be creating a mythology for future generations.
Yeah, Legacy is something of a dark fairy tale, and I'm reminded of the first draft of the Brothers Grimm collection. Before they sanitized the stories for popular release, they were really being sociologists and collecting these weird, dark, dead-end stories from the peasantry around southern Germany.
How very Carl Jung.
Yeah, Carl Jung.
Yeah. And I was raised on those stories like a girl who trod on a loaf that always had grisly, hideous endings where you're plunged down to hell and you can't move and you have insects crawling on your eyes for the rest of eternity. Yeah, my mother loved those stories.
Well, in a lot of these stories, the evil stepmother was actually the devouring mother, which is a serious Jungian image. And in Cinderella, for example, the the stepsisters would cut off their toes to try to fit into the slipper.
Well, was it the red shoes? In the end, she can't stop dancing, and she has to beg the woodsman to cut her feet off. And he chops her legs off, and they live happily ever after.
Well, your book Lullaby is a perfect example of this. That book centers around an invented mythology. It's a chant that can kill, a culling song. And Lullaby was written, well, you've mentioned that it was in the wake of your father's murder and the trial during which the killer was given the death penalty. So the idea of words that can bring death really inspired that.
Well, actually, I was at Bed Bath & Beyond with a friend, and we were looking for a wedding present. And she started to point out how the most sacred symbols of previous cultures had now been reduced to decorating motifs and china patterns in our decorative, you know, objects and disposable things. And she pointed out how things that had once been so sacred that people couldn't look at them or really kept them sheltered were now things that we wiped our faces with or worse.
Yeah, there's a great story for pop culture fans of Star Trek. Leonard Nimoy, when he was a young man, was in synagogue, and everybody was instructed to turn around while the rabbi gave a blessing. And the gesture that the rabbi used to give the blessing was the hand gesture that later became the live long and prosper gesture for Mr. Spock. And it was only Leonard Nimoy turning around and defying instruction to see that blessing that allowed that to happen. So that's almost a classic mythological moment right there, defying the priestly instruction.
I think that's what they call cultural misappropriation, Mr. Spock. It also brings to mind the idea of Lot's wife turning into the pillar of salt. Yeah, be careful.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is author, journalist, graphic novelist, and provocateur extraordinaire Chuck Palahniuk. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. We're talking about the hero's journey, Joseph Campbell, and the second father is a major part of the hero's journey. And the second father is not always a nice person. Sometimes seems like a toxic person, but sometimes also transforms, turns around. So you had a second father in Fight Club, and you also have a second father in Legacy. The first father is absent, and the second father only appears towards the end.
Right, and not to give too much away, the second father is not really explored very much, but it's implied that the second father will sort of be a benefit after the end of the book.
A mentor, like Yoda, you know?
Right, right. Maybe a kind of a corrupt mentor, like, ah.
But since the protagonist is corrupt, the shoe fits.
Well, you know, he's kind of graduated to a greater awareness of self and of his place in history, which is something that troubles me, and that I was kind of getting to in the foreword to the book, is that my family used to have this huge collection of buttons, and they were all memory cues, and my grandmother could pull any of these little strings of buttons out of this box, and she could tell these stories going back hundreds of years about where these buttons had come from and what their purpose had been. And we, in turn, were being trained to learn these stories so that we could relate them. But then in the 1970s, as everything kind of fell apart, this box of 200-year-old buttons disappeared. And so I think we're all kind of losing an idea of our context.
And the buttons were a physical reminder of these stories. They're like a photograph.
No, I don't say that. I say that they're tactile.
Right.
Because they are, especially when you're a child, they're very tactile. It's very important to touch the things that have been touched by your ancestors. And in that way, to have a physical sense of what their life was like. Especially things like shoe buttons or buttons, things that were touched repeatedly. There's even a kind of a school of parapsychology that says that these objects can be read for memories. but they are, they do suggest rosary beads or worry beads or prayer beads. These are the very tactile things that are touched in moments of meditation.
And it's the tactile things that spark the memories that allow people to memorize things.
Right. They do add to that sense of, you know, of a memory cue. They ingrain the memory in a whole different way.
And so in the book Legacy, the tree is in all of these photographs and going back more generations in illustrations and paintings.
Right. And also the idea that if somebody has the determination, the dedication to color all of the illustrations in this beautifully bound hardcover book. And Dark Horse has really produced these books like coffee table books so that they are worth the effort to finish. But if somebody does finish one, it is a kind of a memory cue, a real sort of demonstration of affection and dedication.
And there's also dedication in finding all of the great details in the illustrations that are done by the artists.
You know, that's one thing about coloring books is my editor, Scott Alley, he and I had to identify what makes for good coloring. And so everything has to have a pattern. All the shapes have to be contained. The lines have to be really bold. There's nothing sketchy about these because they have to be, all the fields have to be filled in by someone.
I think my favorite detail was a D's Nuts graffiti on the walls of the... did you not even notice that?
I didn't notice that. I noticed a lot of graffiti that refers back to Fight Club 2.
Okay.
And a lot of snowflakes. We wanted snowflakes throughout the whole book.
Well, let's mention snowflake in the modern context is a term that you coined in Fight Club. And actually, Vice magazine recently said that Fight Club has become the ultimate handbook for men's rights activists. They like to quote the line, "You are not a beautiful or unique snowflake. You are the same decaying organic matter as everything else."
You know, it's funny, and I think sad, actually, frankly, sad, that the only two books or movies that are really cited in political discourse are Fight Club and The Matrix. They've both provided the language and the metaphors that people really talk about politics with these days. And I think it's because so many movies and books just operate out of an assumed stock reality that we're seeing so few narratives that kind of reinvent reality and kind of present a really fresh, different, new reinvented reality. I wish there was more of that.
Well, you mentioned The Matrix. Matrix and Fight Club were both released in 1999, I believe in the fall of 1999. And at that time, I mean, I was in Seattle for the World Trade Organization ministerial. I was in the streets seeing very similar scenes playing out. So that was obviously on the anti-authoritarian left that there was all this fascination with The Matrix and Fight Club. And lately, Fight Club has become the favorite book of a number of white nationalists, leaders of the so-called alt-right. So I don't know, it's maybe a mirror being held up to the times. You've somehow found this stained glass window that everybody can see something different in.
Well, and the Antifa also has really embraced Fight Club and has used it as the basis of starting these training courses at colleges around the country. The whole punch a Nazi thing has come from Fight Club.
I should mention, by the way, that the ending of the book and the ending of the film are two very different animals, Fight Club. So so you can come up with your interpretations based on whether you're a fan of the movie or a fan of the book.
And it's funny, and in European editions of the book, in foreign editions, the publishers have actually rewritten the ending so that the book ends the way the movie ends.
Oh, wow.
Because they think that their readership will want the movie ending. And these are things I don't want to know.
Well, what about the time we're living in right now? I can't help but call to mind a quote from Fight Club when the narrator said, "I found freedom. Losing all hope was freedom."
Yeah, what about it?
I mean, you hear so many people saying that now, that they've lost all hope. But is that a call to inaction or a call to action?
Okay, here I'm going to sound really old. I'm going to sound all Grandpa Simpson right now. But I'm a child of the 1970s, And in the 1970s, we were raised on narratives of romantic fatalism, where the bad news bears trained like crazy, and they still lost. And Rocky trained like crazy.
The first Rocky.
And that's the only one that counts.
Right.
He lost. And what's his name in Saturday Night Fever? John Travolta trained like crazy. And he won, and then he found out that the dance contest was corrupt, and he actually lost. So I was raised on narratives in which people strove for an objective, and they didn't get it, but instead they got something more profound. They got community, they got love, they got something much deeper than this kind of superficial goal that they were going for. And so I think those narratives right now are really important to us, that we might not get the immediate goal that we think we want, but ultimately we're getting something much more lasting and profound and important.
Now, is this one of the reasons why you're finding the storytelling medium of comics so attractive? You've been doing so many comics projects apart from your prose writing.
You know, comics are attractive for a lot of reasons. One is I love working with younger people, and I love working with local people as opposed to people in New York that are so far away and will never really be a social part of my life. And I also like the low culture nature of comics. That people expect a novelist to solve all your problems with every book. And there's just so much brought to bear on novelists that a novel really has to change the world. And so the idea of just doing some low culture things, comics or coloring books, where the pressure is so much less, that's very attractive. You know, if somebody had gone to Sylvia Plath or David Foster Wallace and said, "You want to write Spider-Man? How about you write 14 issues of Spider-Man?" I think they'd both be still alive. You know, the novelists, they really need a break from high culture.
You're reminding me of that great Michael Chabon book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, where these two characters, one a refugee from Eastern Europe in the 30s, are there at the birth of comics. And they're low-paid characters who are writing these cheap action stories, but these old mythologies and these mythological rivalries just keep finding their way into these stories.
There you are.
Right.
And it won the Pulitzer Prize.
Well, you drew a comparison between comics creators and prose writers, and you said that, "I find that comics people are forced to collaborate as part of their medium, and it makes them better, more socialized people."
They are, and they're all independent contractors, and they don't know who they're going to be working with from one project to the next. And so I think that makes them a little more circumspect and a lot more fun to be around.
When you first got the spark for the Fight Club 2 comic series, it was around the table with some local comics writers, Brian Michael Bendis, Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick, and the midwife was really a prose writer friend of yours, Chelsea Kane.
Right. Chelsea put together this party where people were going to kind of pitch me and explain to me the process. And it was really overwhelming, this whole new learning curve and how to write these things, this whole very different storytelling form. And if it hadn't come through people I already trusted, people like Chelsea, I never would have ventured there.
It sounds like you almost came to Dark Horse, the local comics publisher, by accident, because so many of the artists that you admired, Cameron Stewart, David Mack, were working with Dark Horse.
And it really was more to do with Scott Alley. Scott was also a friend of Chelsea's, and Scott was the person who read my initial script and responded to it just within 24 hours. And boy, if there's one way to get a writer, it's by responding very quickly to their work.
And you have even more comics projects on the horizon. There's a couple online. The artist Gabor Kiss has created online comics adaptations of your novels Invisible Monsters and Lullaby. I'm not sure how many other projects we can talk about, but I've heard that you're writing a series of original short stories for comics, and these are one-shot comics. They'll be collected eventually into a single book.
You know, and that's kind of way down the road. You know, next year I have a prose novel coming out in May called Adjustment Day.
Adjustment Day.
Right, and that is that's going to be a bloodbath. My my regular publisher, Doubleday, seemed so excited for it, and then ultimately turned it down because they were afraid it would cause so much social unrest. they really thought that it would be a book that would lead to people being killed. And then my original publisher, W.W. Norton, read it and thought it was a great comedy. And Doubleday UK in Great Britain read it and thought it was a great comedy too. So it really is interesting how people can read the same book and either see it as the end of the world or, you know, a lot of laughs.
Well, this sounds like a continuation of this satirical horror kick that you started with The Lullaby. You amped things up with the short story Guts, which became part of the novel Haunted. You termed these stories transgressional fiction. And maybe your publisher was thinking about the stories behind the tour that you did for the story Guts. You told people that this story should last about as long as you can hold your breath. And you went to different cities. And gosh, how many people ended up fainting at these readings?
You know, the first year, I quit counting once we reached a total of 73. And that was just 1 year out of several years I read that story. And the most was in Brighton, at the Brighton Fringe Festival. I was in this enormous hall that held 800 or 900 people, and 18 people fainted when I read the story. And then most recently, I read it at a synagogue, of all places, in Washington, D.C., this historic, I believe it's called the I Street Synagogue, and five people fainted. And I ended the story with colored lights, the ambulance lights, reflecting off the stained glass windows as the ambulances arrived for these five people who had passed out. And I have no idea. It is, at this point, hundreds of people have fainted.
I wonder, though, with all of your one-upsmanship on yourself, on pushing the limits of prose, of horror and satire, if you can keep up with the zeitgeist, if you can keep up with the politics now. People are saying that satire is dead, that the pronouncements coming out of the White House are becoming indistinguishable from headlines in The Onion or The Daily Show.
You know, but there's always people to listen to. And when I'm at parties, my job is not to talk. I spend most of my time just listening to people, and I hear them tell the most amazing, funny, secret things that just aren't in the culture yet. And I think the secret of my success is to always find these unexpressed things and bring those to the market.
Yeah, you've become kind of a mentor to younger writers, and you're getting these stories out of your head, these transgressional stories, as you call them, has really helped people come up to you and confess, like you're a clergy member, like you're a priest, and they bring you all of these amazing, weird, tragicomic stories.
They do, and also, it doesn't just give them permission to tell the stories. It also, you know, I hope, creates a kind of sort of shocking clearing in their life where they realize that the world is not as cut and dried and not the finished thing that they think it is. Yeah, there was one example. I was at the dollar store. I was at the dollar store in the Hollywood District, and I hope this man will forgive me, but there was a young man in a really styling coat. He was a fantastic overcoat with a stand-up collar. And I noticed the coat, and then I noticed the man appeared in every aisle I was in. And finally, he approached me, and he said, "I hope you don't mind my saying hello, but I was at your adult storytelling event that you did at Broadway Books." And that was a time when I was first experimenting with this adult storytelling form where the audience was invited to come in their pajamas. And I would read with Chelsea Kane, and I would read with Lydia Yuknovich and Monica Drake, and we would wear our pajamas. And I was also ordering these huge cases of oversized carnival stuffed animals from the Lippmann Company. So the first 50, 100 people in line would get these enormous giraffes or penguins or lions.
The famous party store in Portland.
Right. And these were so huge that they dwarfed the adults holding them and made people look even more childlike. But this young man in the dollar store, he said, I went to your event. I was standing in line. My brother had died the day before. And I wasn't closer to anyone in the world than I was to my brother. And I was so devastated by his death. I was just on autopilot. And I had tickets for your event. So I just went because I didn't know what to do. And I was standing there outside Broadway Books with all these people. And you walked up and you gave me an enormous stuffed penguin that was almost as big as I was. And the moment was so ridiculous that I realized that the world still held some surprises and things that I couldn't anticipate, a joy that I could not conceive of at that moment was still possible. And that penguin, that ridiculous, stupid gesture, gave me what I needed to keep moving forward in my life. And I just want to thank you for that. And so I think that rather than shocking people, the objective is always to kind of present something that so amazes them that it makes them aware that the world holds far more surprises, far more joy than they could ever anticipate in the current moment.
What a liminal moment.
And you know what I said? I said, dude, that is a great looking coat. Where'd you get that coat? Because I didn't know what to say.
What you said just reminds me of some of the temple carvings you'll see in old Buddhist temples and Hindu temples, sometimes in Mesoamerican temples, that are just scenes of horror, of dismemberment, of the worst kinds of deaths and afterlives. And the idea that the terrible and the sacred can be flip sides of each other. There can be that portal there.
And that is so much how humor or ecstasy works, is it the idea is you create this enormous amount of tension and you add to that tension and you just build that tension. And then as quickly as possible, you try to resolve that tension. And the faster you can resolve that enormous built up tension, the greater the relief will be, and people will respond with ecstasy or with laughter. And so, you know, that's always the goal, is to keep building tension and then to resolve the tension very, very quickly so that people feel that big rush of ecstasy.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm S.W. Konser, and my guest today is author, journalist, and graphic novelist Chuck Palahniuk. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. Did you ever see the Jim Jarmusch movie, Only Lovers Left Alive?
No, sorry.
Oh, yeah. It was these two vampires were on opposite sides of the world, one in Detroit and one in Morocco and Marrakesh. And the whole idea was that being immortal just gets so damn tedious. So one of the characters is looking for a way out, and he has a bullet crafted from hardwood that will pierce his heart. But that same energy really comes into the story and legacy, that you've got these characters who are immortal. And it can be a real drag. It can really destroy your personality.
Well, and that's part of the reveal I don't want to go to yet.
Okay.
But when you're young, you know, your youth, your vitality, your appearance is really your source of power. And so I think immortality is especially attractive to young people because they can't conceive of a form of power more effective than youth and beauty. But as you age, you see that that immortality is a lot less attractive.
Before Fight Club, before even Invisible Monsters, you were working as a journalist, and you're still writing nonfiction pieces for newspapers and magazines. Were you a fan of the new journalism of the 1970s, where writers like Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson would really immerse themselves in the stories they were covering?
You know, I think initially I was. But like any new style, it gets picked up and it gets practiced by people who aren't as good at it. And so that kind of gonzo journalism that was as much about the journalist as about the topic became so self-conscious that I really got sick of it. I would read these articles in magazines where the first 6 or 7 column inches of this nonfiction article is about the writer choosing the right color of necktie and all the factors that are going into getting dressed for the interview. And I would be so annoyed by that it really soured me on this gonzo journalism.
There's a collection that you put together, Stranger Than Fiction, True Stories. Is there a thread that links those together? Are you still happy with that book?
You know, I'm happy with parts of that book. There was a lot of pressure at the time from my editor to do a collection of nonfiction because I'd enjoyed so many of Joan Didion's collections of essays.
Right.
And my editor really wanted that book. And I wish I'd had 20 years to write that book instead of 2 or 3 years. It would have been a much better book.
Would you like to redo it, maybe with some new material?
No, you know, Nora Ephron has done that. She had that fantastic book, Crazy Salad Plus 9, where she used the very best essays from her collection, Crazy Salad, and she added 9 fresh essays. But I don't see that happening. You know, nonfiction is okay, but fiction and comics are a lot more fun.
Well, last time you were here, you said, so much of my writing is actually a kind of field study, talking to people and looking for what they're upset about. I'm much more of a Studs Terkel than I am a Faulkner.
You know, I'm always finding some aspect of human experience, and then I take it to a party, and I tell this one anecdote that I've heard. And if it's a good story, it will evoke other stories, very similar stories. Because when people tell stories in a social setting, it's almost like they're laying out their hands of cards in a game. Oh, that happened to me once, but a better version. And then people will escalate.
One upsmanship.
Exactly. And so you see the same basic anecdote escalate based on other people's lives. But you're seeing the same basic dynamic demonstrated in more and more entertaining, dramatic, upsetting ways. So my job is to take an anecdote. For example, I was on tour a couple of years ago, and I was in Los Angeles, and the publicist taking me to the event, as we were driving through the Hollywood Hills, she said friends of hers had just bought this very modern house, you know, cantilevered over the canyon, and it had this very minimalistic fireplace where gas jets made blue flames dance over this bed of crushed white granite. But they couldn't understand why every winter the house stunk really bad. It just stunk to high heavens. They were almost ready to move away. And then a neighbor had stopped by and said, did you know the previous owners had had a cat? And apparently this cat, for years, had been defecating in this crushed white gravel in the fireplace as a cat box. And so that every winter when they flipped the switch and they set the gas jets ablaze, they were basically parboiling all of this cat poop in their living room. It's a great story, but I would tell that story and people would tell me very similar stories that were even worse. And then ultimately in Seattle, someone told a story about some friends of theirs who'd flipped the switch at the moment, unknown to them, that the cat was actually in the fireplace relieving itself. And this blazing cat had shot around the house and set their living room on fire. And it's a classic, classic animal burning the house down story. David Sedaris tells this story with a burning mouse in the pile of leaves. Mark Richard told this story with his short story Strays. But it's such an archetype story that I knew that by collecting all the versions of the cat in the fireplace story that I'd heard from dozens of people, that I'd kind of baited from them using the one event I'd heard of in Hollywood, that eventually it built the story, but it built it from the experience of like 100 people's lives. And that's kind of what I do in that Studs Terkel sort of, harvesting way.
The archetype of the blazing animal.
The archetype of the animal that burns the house down is a classic form of short story.
I'm going way back here, but there was a TV series in the 80s, 90s called Northern Exposure. And there was a sociologist who was from a Northwestern indigenous nation who went around collecting the stories of the Anglo people in the community. And they were all urban legends. And he was looking for something transformational in these stories. And there never was a moral or a transformational moment. They were just these weird urban legends, like the Mexican rat.
The Mexican pet.
The Mexican
pet. The Chihuahua
pet.
Turns out to be a rat. Yeah.
Yes.
But if you look at them in a kind of Carl Jung way, where you're not looking for them to actually dictate, they typically talk about something more profound than a real sort of cautionary tale. To demonstrate how old I am, back in the 70s, there was a series of books, eventually a movie, and I think they were called The Prometheus Syndrome. And they were about an ecological disaster where a coal mine had released this species of deep subterranean cockroach that could actually rub its back legs together and create sparks. And these cockroaches were free, and they infested American cities, and they began to set buildings and houses on fire. So suddenly we had these fire-starting cockroaches in everyone's house. End of story. So again, we've got the animal. They're always a kind of story about doing wrong to nature. They're always about some cruelty to an animal, and the animal ultimately having its revenge by destroying your life.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is author, journalist, graphic novelist, and provocateur extraordinaire Chuck Palahniuk. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. Somewhere I saw that you said that you're just fascinated by archetypes, particularly trickster characters like Loki, Hermes, and Coyote. And these are all characters, especially Coyote, the Southwest indigenous trickster, who constantly get killed. And yet, maybe one part of them will remain and they'll come back to life and they'll learn nothing from their horrible experience, but they'll just go on doing whatever they did before.
Yeah, and so much of that is based on reading Lewis Hyde. He had a fantastic book called Trickster Creates the World or Trickster Makes the World. That's a great book. And it's also his book, The Gift. Both of those books have had a lot of impact on my work.
Right. You said, and because Tyler Durden was always a trickster, I wanted to give him eternal status among the gods.
Right. And I wanted to, in the same way that the tree in Legacy is traced back as a possession through all the previous generations of this man's life. Every one of his ancestors has possessed this tree. In Fight Club 2, we find out that every one of the narrator's ancestors has had a relationship with Tyler. And the Tyler has, in a way, groomed them all to create the narrator who would be the ultimate sort of recipient of Tyler's mission.
Yes, in Fight Club 2, the narrator, I believe in Fight Club 2 of the comic series, he's known as Sebastian. In the past, he's been Jack and Joe and who knows what all. But he's now married to Marla Singer. And Marla and the narrator are supposedly settled down. He's got a job at a military contractor. But neither of them are really settled down. Marla wants Tyler Durden back. And the narrator, to some extent, does too. And they have a son. And the story gets into territory ripped from today's headlines. Some really serious terrorism stuff played for comic effect in places.
Boy. And I never think of myself as comic. I think that people don't know how to label it, so it gets labeled as comic. Because it is so tragic. So many of the elements are fantastically sad. And whenever I work in a medium, I really want to play to the strengths of that medium. So that there are things in Fight Club 2 that are so enormously sad that they could not be made literal enough to be shot as a movie. If you made an army of dying children, an army of children who all had progeria, the advanced aging disease, then you couldn't make that in a movie. It would be so overwhelmingly sad, it could never be done in a movie. But in comics, you have that wiggle room where it can be presented in such a way that people feel an emotional distance from it. And it's not so overwhelmingly tragic that you can't read the story that includes that element. That's the glory of comics. It's like a movie, but it's a movie in which you can do things that you could never do in a movie. They're not necessarily sad, and they're definitely not funny. So they kind of occupy that incomplete place, that undecided place, which I think Jacques Derrida would love. The undecided thing that people are always going to have to argue about. That's why abortion, so many of my stories include some element of abortion, because it is that enormous undecided social issue that will never be resolved and will always generate sort of a feeling of uncomfortableness and conflict.
That's both a benefit and a curse to the comics form, that people take it as being more lighthearted than other ways of communicating a story.
And ultimately, you don't want people to get it the first time through. You don't want them to get everything. You want them to be able to read this over and over. And then ultimately, you want them to have to take it to other people. There was a sociologist named Shirley Bryce Heath, and she said, what makes a book a classic is when it creates a community of people who have to come together in order to understand the book. And so that's why so many of the Tolkien books are classics, because they've created this community of people who really love to come together and discuss them. And so you want to present a story that is so funny or so tragic or so undecidable that people have to go to one another and say, will you read this? Because I want to talk about this. I'd really like you to read this. So many people I know take my books and say, I met my wife because she read your books and I read your books and we connected over this thing we both needed to discuss. So in comics or novels or anything, you don't want it to be completely consumable in the first pass. You want people to have to consume it over and over, and then to consume it in the company of other people. And that's what will keep it alive.
I love that you name-check Jacques Derrida, the linguist who was this professor of semiotics who loved to take apart language to argue whether words actually had intrinsic meaning. And I have to wonder, I don't remember Derrida ever having anything to say about comics.
But he did talk, his favorite metaphor was the zombie, and to some extent, lesser extent, the vampire, because the zombie represented for him the ultimate undecided thing. It wasn't alive and it wasn't dead. And so all zombie narratives are about resolving the zombie and making it a dead thing. It's a dead thing, but it presents as a live thing. So it has to be resolved. Same thing with a vampire. And so that was his metaphor for how Western culture was so binary, and it really always sought to resolve the thing that was unresolved.
Have you read the book The Serpent and the Rainbow by Wade Davis?
No, I've seen the movie, that's all.
Yeah, the Sam Raimi movie. The book is fascinating because he traveled to Haiti and met the priests who would zombify people. Basically, he was looking for a medication that would allow medical patients to be anesthetized. Well, the zombie potion was useless for that, but it slowed down heart rates. It allowed people to look dead for a period of time. But when they came back, the people of the community would not recognize them as living people. And that was what turned them into zombies, was that they were no longer considered living people in their own community.
Interesting. You know, because so much of my work is sort of about dramatizing Victor Turner, his work about liminal rituals, where, for example, in honeymoon, the honeymoon is that period where the couple is married in front of their peers, but then they have to leave their community for a period of time. And once they come back to their community, they're received back as this completely different thing. Similar to once the zombie is removed as a zombie, once it comes back, it will always be the zombie. Once you come back from the limnoid or the liminal ritual, then you will always be the new thing.
That's like the hero's journey, where the protagonist has to leave and be challenged before coming back altered.
There you are. He's doing the same thing over and over.
Well, before we go, I want to make sure to name check Tom Spanbauer again. When you were in the studio last time, you talked about the writing workshops hosted by Tom Spanbauer, Portland's Dean of Dangerous Writing. You and Monica Drake were Tom's original students, and the workshops just grew from there.
Yeah, we were. You know, and there was four of us sitting around Tom's kitchen table, paying him $20 a week. And it was a fantastic time. It was, it made me a writer. Tom's not teaching right now. He quit a couple of years ago because of health problems. But beginning this winter, I'll be teaching with Lydia Yuknovich.
Oh.
She and I are going to be running as close as we can to Tom's workshop. But out of her new offices downtown, she runs a program called Corporeal Writing. And that's Lydia Yuknovich.
Yeah, she was just at Wordstock. She was a big draw. Well, you said that Tom's theory was that the writing itself should be therapeutic. It should allow you to exhaust your feelings around a frightening, unresolved personal issue.
Right. And the idea of exploring the issue and exaggerating the issue and making it as awful as it could possibly be, and then exhausting your emotional reaction to it. That by the time you were done with the story or the book, the issue was completely resolved. It's amazing how once your emotional attachment to it is gone, the issue just vanishes.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you're teaming up with Lydia Yuknovich. I mean, that sounds like a redoubtable team there.
You know, we're kind of good cop, bad cop. Lydia is very nurturing and very supportive, and I'm very like John Houseman in The Paper Chase. I am a horrible teacher. I am brutal. And so we make a very good cop, bad cop.
Well, I think some people would argue with that. I mean, you've been posting essays for the past decade or more about the craft of writing on your site, The Cult, as well as the sister site, Lit Reactor. And in fact, you've been really encouraging fans. There's a collection of fan-written stories that you compiled in the anthology Burnt Tongues.
And it's funny because most of those essays that I put out there have been compiled and are now being used illegally at Columbia University as a textbook. Friends of mine in the television and writing programs there have sent me pictures of this textbook that is basically downloaded and Xeroxed and sold to students at Columbia.
Oh, they're not even bothering to just get the PDF. They're Xeroxing these days.
Yeah, it's sad. It's but what the hell? You know, maybe someday I'll do a writing book and make a real thing.
So you're kind of not willing to go to the trouble of doing a cease and desist letter.
Well, but it's also kind of a slippery slope because Tom Spanbauer learned so many of these techniques and the terminology from Gordon Lish at Columbia, when Lish was really the Captain Fiction, the Esquire editor and the Knopf editor, and everyone wanted to write like Raymond Carver. And so Tom took Gordon's method and sort of added his own ideas to it, and that's what he taught us. And so much of the terms like horses and burnt tongue were developed by Gordon Lish. So it's really hard for any one person to lay claim to this terminology and to all these techniques when they are compiled from so many other people.
In a way, it sounds like that legacy of writing is like the tree in Legacy. It keeps getting handed down. It sheds its leaves. It grows new fruit. And it goes on from hand to hand, generation to generation.
And you're always looking for someone who will become the custodian and sort of take care of this thing and preserve this thing and pass it down to the next person.
Like the tree that goes through, what, 50 generations before before the fruit ripens.
Right, before somebody else gets a career out of it.
Well, the book is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color, featuring art by Steve Morris, Mike Norton, Duncan Fregretto, and Nate Picos. The author is Chuck Palahniuk. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
Now, for our listeners who want to keep up with all of your projects, how can they find out more? We mentioned The Cult, the official fan site at chuckpalahniuk.net. You should probably spell that.
Boy, you know, that's the best thing is the cult site. And it's Chuck Palahniuk, PALAHNIUK.net.
And litreactor.com is good, too.
Litreactor, the teaching site.
You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. Thanks to Ken Jones for his recording assistance, and to David Hyde and Scott Alley for their promotional help. And thanks to everyone for tuning in today.